We had intended this morning, in honor of Jewish Music Month, to present for you a number of songs and with their accompaniments, which are among the first art songs composed for the modern synagogue. They were written by Salomone Rossi, who lived at almost the very end of the Italian Renaissance. He was born in 1570 and died in 1630. And the choir, together with some people who played the flutes and the cello, were going to present that music to us, and I was going to comment on it. But unfortunately, the Malach Movis has been among us this last few days, and our music director's grandmother died on Friday, and so we've had to postpone that musical service till next week, when we will present it to you, and obviously the comments I want to make on it, I will save for next week. But since you came prepared to think of themes musical, I thought it might not be inappropriate to spend some few minutes this morning thinking over a musical theme, one not usually faced, I think, by most of us in life or from the pulpit. And that is just precisely what does Judaism think about music? Now, we assume that music is one of those things everyone is in favor of. And the Greeks, of course, thought of music as a gift of the gods. Music was the senior of all the muses. Greek education was divided into seven major categories, and one of these was, of course, music. And music was held to be not only a method of cultivating the spirit, but also part of the necessary cultivation of the body. For in measure as one had internalized the rhythms and harmonies of the universe, one had brought a certain grace, a certain sense of quality to one's deportment, to the way one stood and walked and lived. The greatest of the Greek musicians was Orpheus. Orpheus's harp and song, we're told, had the power to charm all of the violence out of the jungle. The animals, once they heard his song, would come from their lairs and their hutches and sit at his feet and listen to his melody. Orpheus appears first in Greek legend as one of the companions with Jason, one of the Argonauts, a search for the Golden Fleece. The other Argonauts were heroes, which is to say they were soldiers. And Orpheus's only weapon was his music. But it was a weapon which could penetrate where other more bloody instruments could not. And typically the story is told that one day when the companions had to pass through a narrow mountain defile in order to reach their goal, they found this little valley fronted by a fiery, fire-smoking dragon. And the soldiers hurled their spears and loosed their arrows against the dragon, but his thick skin was thick, and the spears and arrows fell off harmlessly. Orpheus picked up his harp, and he began to play and to sing. And he sang a very sleep-inducing melody, and the fire-breathing dragon fell asleep, and the companions were able to pass by in safety. Now, music has its charms, and many of us use music in just the way that this myth suggests. It's been a long day. We've been pressured. We're tired. We come home. We put on one of our favorite tapes or records, and somehow the cares of the world slip away, and we find ourselves suddenly, in half hour, an hour later, wide awake, refreshed, and having put aside all of the burdens of the workaday world. Now, as Jews, we know we come from a music-loving people. It's hard to think of the modern concert stage denuded of all of the fine Jews who have conducted the major symphony orchestras and been the virtuosi who have played the piano or the violin and thrilled us at concerts the world over. I love the Isaac Stern's description of the cultural exchange that took place some years ago on a musical level between the Soviet Union and the United States. He said it's very simple. The Soviet Union sends the United States its Jewish violinist from Odessa, and we send to the Soviet Union our Jewish violinist from Odessa. And we, of course, as you well know, in biblical times, music played a major role in the worship of the synagogue. I read to you this morning from the psalm which speaks of singing unto the Lord a new song, and the song is accompanied with timbrel and lyre and harp and all of the instruments of antiquity. But the question that I'd like to put before you, the issue I'd like to put before you, is a rather more complex one. And it has to do with whether or not music is simply one of the great joys of life, or whether it has other powers, things which are not quite as charming as we normally think of. There is a very eccentric, rather successful American publisher at the turn of the century named Elbert Hubbard. And Elbert Hubbard wrote a little book called The 1001 Sayings, in which he set out his great wisdom for the American public. And one of his sayings was this: music is the only one of the arts which cannot be put to base use. And that's the proposition that I'd like to examine this morning. Because I can't free my mind of the medieval legend of the Pied Piper, who used his music to lead the children of medieval German cities to their death. And I remember that Hitler used music in Nuremberg, and that the generals and tyrants of the world have always used the bagpipe or the drum or the trumpet to lead their troops to their death, to battle. Music has its charms, but it has many powers. And the interesting question is, are we really conscious, aware, always, of the various powers for good and ill which music has, various controls it has over our emotions and therefore over our lives? Interestingly, whereas the Greeks and the Egyptians and the Babylonians assumed music to be a gift of God, by the grace of the gods to man, the Jews believed that music was simply a human art. In that list of genealogical list which follows on the story of the Garden of Eden, among Adam's immediate ancestors is one Yubal. And Yubal is defined as the father of all those who play the lyre and the flute. In other words, the biblical myth assumes that music is of human manufacture, a man-made art. And like all that is of human artifice, it takes to itself all of the contradictions and all of the confusions which are bound up inexorably with human nature. And so when we look into Scripture, we find stories which tell us of the wondrous powers of music to calm the human spirit. The most famous of these deals with King David and King Saul. How did David happen to get into the court of the king? He did so because as a youth he was cunning with his hands in the playing of the lyre. And we're told that Saul was one of those terribly disturbed men, a ruler who was not only burdened with the cares of government, but who was burdened by all kinds of black, dark thoughts, melancholia. And only David's singing at night could soothe the ravages of the day and calm his mind. The Bible puts it this way: "And it came to pass that when the evil spirit of God came upon Saul, that David took a harp and played with his hands. So Saul was refreshed, and all was well, and the evil spirit departed from him." But there's another story told about Saul and music in the Bible. He seems to be uniquely susceptible to music. One day when he was a much younger king, he was wandering about in the provinces, and he happened to see a group of ecstatics, of dervishes, coming down from a shrine. And the Bible tells us that they were preceded by men playing timbrels and the cymbals and the lyre and the harp and the flute. And they were singing and dancing, and Saul was caught up in the contagion of this music. And he began to dance and to sing and to speak with tongues ecstatically. And Samuel makes this comment to Saul about this event, that in the process, v'ner pachta li'ish acher, you were turned into a totally other human being. You ceased to be yourself. And music has, in many ways, that capacity. If we're in a group, the music is ecstatic enough or frenzied enough to turn us into something other than the controlled person we would like to think we are all of the time. So music has its charms and music has its powers. And the question that the Bible faces, the question that all civilized groups must face, is how these powers are to be used and what the power of music is at a particular time over a particular culture. The Jews, of course, in ancient times used music as part of their ritual. We know very little about the actual ritual of the first temple, of Solomon's temple. But the priestly histories and the Talmud and Josephus tell us a good bit about the ceremony in the temple during the 6 centuries from the Babylonian exile to its final destruction in the year 70. And we know from these records that among the many responsibilities of the Levites was to be a choir, in their case, an entirely male choir. And that the choir was backed up by instrumentalists, largely an ensemble largely consisting of men who played on the nevel and the kinnor, 2 kinds of harps. One apparently had 7 strings, the other apparently had 10 strings. In addition to this rather large ensemble of stringed instruments, there were 1 or 2 men in this, shall we call it an orchestra, who played on the cymbals and who would bang together the cymbals, an indication that a particular phrase or a particular part of the service had ended. Because we are insatiably curious about the past, archaeology has developed a sub-specialty, a small group of people who are interested in trying to recreate the music of ancient times. Now, the earth has yielded up a number of instruments, those instruments which are made of non-perishable material. We have dug up from the earth in the Middle East bells and cymbals and bone clappers and ivory horns and things of this kind. But of course, any instrument that was made out of a perishable organic substance, the drums, the harps, have been lost. But the people of scholars are undaunted, and many have built models of the harps and the lyres and these other instruments, the drums, as they are seen on and depicted on Greek vase painting, in Egyptian tomb paintings, or in the little clay miniature figures that appear sometimes in ancient tombs. And then occasionally archaeologists are lucky. In 1924, Sir Leonard Woolley was excavating at Ur. Ur was one of the great cities where the Tigris and Euphrates rivers come together and pour into the Persian Gulf. And early in the 3rd millennium before the Common Era, it was one of the great city-states of the ancient world. And one day when Woolley was walking around these excavations, he noticed a hole in the ground. It looked like the hole of an animal. A less conscientious archaeologist would have walked by. But Willie had some of his people prepare a liquid of hot wax. And he poured this liquid down the hole. And then they cut away the area. And they found that the liquid had filled in the space which had once been occupied by an ancient harp. A harp which was 3.5 feet wide, 3 feet tall, 12 stringed. And when the wax hardened, they were able to bring out of the earth an exact model of a 3rd millennium before the Common Era musical instrument. And the wax was such that it had actually adhered to it some of the gold gilt which had once been on the box, the music sounding box of the harp, and had somehow remained in the earth when the rest of the wood had perished. And of course, craftsmen quickly built a wooden harp, identical in all of its elements to this harp, which had somehow been resurrected from antiquity. And aided by a number of indications in various cuneiform tablets which have been found, but we know of the folk music of the Near East. Today, musicologists and archaeologists have a fairly clear idea of what the music of the past must have sounded like. It would have seemed strange to us. It was very high-pitched. It was rather nasal in its song. There was no attempt to compose intricate music. They would a series of tones would be sung over and over again, and words were simply be fitted to these particular modulations of sound. And the instruments and the voices sang identical melodies. There was no attempt to orchestrate, to compose in the modern sense. But there was variety. The Bible mentions 19 different musical instruments, and many others are known from other inscriptions in the ancient Middle East. Now, you and I know that when movie producers, when television producers want to induce a certain mood, the soundtrack will come on with certain kinds of predictable music. There's one kind of music for a martial scene. There's another kind of music for a love scene. There's another kind of music which tells us instinctively that this is a moment of great melodrama, of great tragedy. Now, the ancients knew this, but they also were much more specific in their understanding. And if we read the Greek philosophers and we read some of the Mesopotamian writers, we find that it was commonly believed in the ancient world that certain juxtapositions of sound inevitably induced in the human being a certain emotional response. There was one melody, let's call it. One melody which was specific for piety, another specific for love, another specific for the arousal of passion, another specific for military heroism. And what ancient musicians did was not to compose, but simply to take the verse, the poetry, and to find ways to fit the appropriate melody from the common 8 or 9 melodies which were basic to that world to the verse which was given to them. And one of the interesting results of this is we can tell something of what our fathers accepted and what they rejected. In the shrines of the Canaanites and others in the ancient world, fertility cults were common. And so those set of notes which were notes of arousal, notes of ecstasy, notes of physical passion, were not unusual in the shrine worship of the day. While in the shrine of Jerusalem, these particular sets of notes were deliberately kept out and deliberately set aside. And when we read scripture, we discover that the prophets never inveigh against music in the synagogue, nor are they opposed to the natural music of workers in the field, of the people who pick the grapes as they tread the grapes to turn it into wine. But they do oppose, and they do attack the music of the banquet hall, the music of the theater, the music of vulgarity, the music of indulgence. And so we find Isaiah saying, "Woe to those who at their banquets have lyre and harp, timbrel, flute and wine, yet who never give a thought to the plan of God." And Amos puts it this way, "Woe to those who are at ease in Zion, those who lie on ivory beds, feasting on lambs from the flock, humming snatches of songs to the tunes of the lute, accounting themselves musicians like David." The issue to the prophets was the purpose to which music was put. Music which was simply the music of indulgence, the music of the rich and the powerful, as they indulged themselves on their ivory couches and feasted while the poor of the land sweated and had little to show. Music which allowed them to forget the responsibilities of their lives. This music was contemptible. This music was attacked. But the music which spoke of worship of God, which reminded the peoples of their duty, the music which accompanied the ceremonies in the shrine, that music was acceptable. Indeed, it was consecrated to God. When we move from biblical times into rabbinic times, we find the rabbis taking a rather negative attitude towards instrumental music generally. As you know, the synagogue put aside the instrumental music of the temple. They said that, the rabbis said it, they did so as a sign of mourning for the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, that the synagogue should not have exactly the same quality, drama, power of worship. And that people who come to the synagogue should always remember the lost glories of Zion. But interestingly, long before the destruction of the temple, we find the sages of our people unhappy with instrumental music. They associated with this theater, and the theater was associated with violence, the games, the gladiatorial fights, and was associated with license, because it often was a display of the naked body, a display of of wantonness. It was a costume display of ribaldry, things which they disapproved of. And they tended to move in there, to speak often about the dangers of instrumental music. They were not unhappy, as the Talmud says, that when the Sanhedrin was abolished, the right to have music in the houses of entertainment was abolished. And one of the rabbis even says, when music enters the door, destruction enters the house. Now, I know of fathers and mothers who might take this literally and who, if their children had become members of a rock and roll band or had taken up drums, might agree that when music enters the house, destruction enters the door. But most of us are conditioned now to think of music as something delightful, full of charm, one of the great glories of civilization. Almost every one of our children has his own tape deck. Houses in the suburbs have wall-to-wall hi-fi equipment. When we're driving in our cars, we have the music on to one or another of the musical stations. We have whatever music it is that particularly pleases us. And it's rather hard for us to think ourselves back into the mind of a rabbi who would say, when music enters the door, destruction enters the house. Yet I want to read to you something from one of the greatest of the philosophers of antiquity, Plato. Plato said this: new styles in music quietly insinuate themselves into manners and customs, and then they become a still greater force. They go on to attack laws and constitutions, displaying the utmost independence until in the end, by overthrowing everything, they destroy all that is of value, both public and private. Now you ask yourself, what kind of philosopher could possibly utter such errant nonsense? What kind of power does music have over the laws and the constitutions of a society? But remember that Plato was a representative of an austere culture, one which spoke of civic duty, one which spoke of rectitude and personal responsibility, one which emphasized the duties of citizenship and believed in moderation and virtue in all things. At that same Athenian society which spawned Plato, spawned the Dionysian and Bacchanalian rites, those displays of musical excess with wine and revelry, in which the people who were caught up in these Bacchanalian rites forgot themselves, danced themselves into frenzy and into madness. And Plato saw in these kinds of musical excesses a threat to the society in which he had great faith. His society was a society of reason. Music appeals to the emotions. Music can turn us into people who are, in many ways, unreasonable. Woodstock in our own generation may have been a great love feast, but many of those throngings of our young people for various kinds of musical groups have become violent, drug-filled, and worse. Plato and the rabbis were both representatives of a determined morality which was afraid of the appeal of music to the emotions, to the passions, an appeal which is stimulative, an appeal which gives to the senses a sense of gratification which allows them to forget for a moment duty, obligation, responsibility, moderation. And we move on then to a life which is lived without a sense of shape, without a set of standards which are immutable and unchangeable. To the rabbis as to Plato, music was as much a blessing as a threat. And that's not a theme that most of us spend any time really thinking about. And yet, if we think back not so many years to the time when people spoke of the development of a counterculture in these United States, we think back to the 1960s, and we think that, remember that the counterculture was not only interested in ending the war in Vietnam, but it was interested in breaking out of all of the traditional, seemingly reasonable restrictions. It was look forward to a time where one could do one's thing without real limitations. It's interesting to remember that it was music, that it was to music that the counterculture people looked for their guidance and for their authority. It was to the Beatles and to the Rolling Stones, to Pete Seeger, and to other people, Bob Dylan, others of this type. These were the leaders in many ways of the counterculture, because they spoke not to the mind represented the past, the institutions people wanted to break away from, but it spoke to feeling, to emotion, to passion. It spoke to the breaking down of the laws and the constitution of the society of which it was a part. And reading Plato against our own almost immediate experience is to recognize that this is not errant nonsense, but is a very interesting insight into the power of music over the human spirit. What does it mean, then, for you and for me, who are, after all, citizens of the most musically saturated age the world has ever known? In the ancient world, there had to be musicians to have music. Now all we need is an instrument. All we need is to turn it on, the radio, the record player, the tape deck, and we are surrounded by music. And our music is not simply the music of actual instruments or actual voices, but it's electronically amplified. I sometimes wonder as I drive through the city and I see these people walking or jogging along the streets with the walkmasters over their ears, tuned up, I presume, to full decibel level. I often wonder, as I walk into homes where music is resounding from the walls, whether or not music is not being used to deafen people to the real world of which they're a part. Music is wonderful in that it is absorbing. When the music is on, you don't have to think. Indeed, I wonder sometimes if the appeal of music to this generation is precisely because it precludes thought. Music appeals to the imagination. Music draws us into ourselves. Music is destructive of community. Music is also a way of tuning out the larger world, the difficulties of the day. But the difficulties of the day cannot be avoided. They have to be ultimately faced, thought about. And I sometimes wonder in my more suspicious moments, really what it is that has made this generation of ours such a musically sensitive, musically involved generation. Is it really that we simply love music? I wonder. Or is it that we need music because we fear to think about so many of the problems of the time? Is it we really need music to simplify life so we don't have to recognize and face its complexity? I don't know. But I place the idea before you as one worthy, at least, of consideration. Now, our fathers of Plato were not able, fortunately, to destroy mankind's love of music. People went on enjoying music, whatever the philosophers or the rabbis said about it. And the rabbis themselves were not consistent in their attitude towards music. Because, interestingly, the very men who said, when music enters the home, destruction enters the home, these very people created what I've been trying without real success to create for the last 28 years, a singing congregation. You sit. Music is played to you. But if you look at the origins of the synagogue, you'll recognize that music was never played to anyone. The rabbis did away with instruments in part because we listen to instruments. We need professionals to play the instruments for us. This is our instrument. And so in the early synagogue, there were no instruments. There was only the sung voice. And there were no cantors in our sense, no virtuosi. Everybody sang the very well-known simple melodies. The words were fit to the simple melodies, which were repeated. It didn't have a great deal of variety. But the entire worship of our people in the early days of the synagogue was sung. You didn't hear the spoken word. You couldn't sit back and be sung to. You, if you had a voice like mine, you hummed along. If you could sing, you sang. But there was a sense of the naturalness and the appropriateness of the music of the synagogue. And so there was this kind of love-hate relationship in Judaism between the tradition and music, which is to say what? The music is not good, the music is not bad, music is. And it's all a question of the way in which we use music. I can't get out of my mind, when I think of music, the image of the crowded Berlin concert halls in the 1930s and early 1940s, filled with the Gauleiters and the heavy high Nazi official and their wives, listening to von Karajan and others conduct Bach, Beethoven. There's nothing in music which instinctively speaks of the higher things of civilization. What we bring to music, to a degree we take from it, the kinds of people we are determine the use that we make of music. But most importantly, we are today, as in so many ways, faced with a, what shall I call it? Musical overkill. Whether we like music or not, that is, whether we like classical music or folk music or jazz or rock and roll, it's not a question of the kinds of music we like. But the question is, has music begun to dominate our lives, or is music simply one of those graces which we add to our lives to give it a certain degree of charm and of beauty? And I have a terrible feeling that for many in this age, music has become a dominant factor in their lives, so much so that it has drowned out, to a very large degree, the more logical, the more reasonable, the more prosaic elements of life, and made it more difficult for these people to come to grips with reality and responsibility. And where this is so, I submit to you it is a tragedy. Amen.